So, in terms of parental certainties, females are always certain. This is what we call maternal certainty. If it comes out of you, you know it's yours. Barring some sort of snafu at the hospital, mixing up kids, and frankly, they are really, you know, concerned about this here in Edmonton at least. I mean, when my first son was born, I mean, he's coming out and all's where he's out. They've slapped a band on him, and that band matches the number, like 18 number system that's on the band that's on my wife, and it's also on her ankle, and I had to wear a band. They check you before you leave with the kid, whether you all got the same bands. You're not allowed to cut them off until you're out of the house. It's like, okay, they do not want mistakes being made. I have no problem with that. Okay. So, maternal certainty. Males, though, males can never be certain. Right? So this is what we call paternal uncertainty. I mean, they might be fairly certain, but it's always a possibility that they're not actually the father. Some very interesting work that's been done with how both maternal relatives and paternal relatives describe the appearance of a child. Now, frankly, newborn children look like squished monkeys. If you've ever seen a newborn, and stuff that you see on TV and like Grey's Anatomy or something does not count because they're not using newborns. Okay, they're using later kids. Like, that is no newborn. Look at the size of that kid. There's no way that came out. The mother would just be exploded open and it's just like, ah. I mean, I don't put it past Grey's Anatomy to do something like that, but I mean, no. Right? Newborn infants. I mean, many newborns, their heads come out shaped like cones, right? Because the bones of the skull aren't sutured, the sutures aren't formed yet, and so, like I said, the head's the biggest thing that's got to get through, so it just squished, and out it comes, and it's kind of, boop, coney, and, you know, that's a little bit like, ooh, creepy looking, you know? And then eventually, you know, it's like, push it back down, it just goes back down. It's fine. Frankly, being born is pretty traumatic, I guess. You know, the muscular contractions, many babies are born like massively bruised from just being squished. Turns out okay. There's even some studies that actually suggest this may actually be adaptive and helps actually kick things like the respiratory system into higher gear, whereas C-section babies don't get that. And so there's sometimes more problems with it. So interesting issues there. But my point is that some of them are covered in fur, like a light sort of downy fur. My point is newborn babies, you know, are red and blotchy and, you know, like misfortunes, and then they're scrunchied and wrinkled, and most of them look barely. My kids, of course, were beautiful. Amazing how that works out. Not all kids are beautiful when they're born. It's like some are just like, ah. Yeah. Maternal relatives. There's been at least three studies that have looked at this. Maternal relatives are more likely to describe features in relatively newborn children, or at least ascribe features like nose shape or ears or whatever. Ascribe those to the supposed father. It's like, oh, look, it's got his ears, eyes, nose, whatever it happens to be. Sixth finger of the left hand, whatever it is. Paternal relatives are not statistically significantly likely to do this. They'll describe features as just being sort of whatever. It's like, oh, I guess that looks sort of like mom's, no, or that looks sort of like dad's. Maternal relatives are much more likely to describe the features as looking like the father, or at least the supposed father. If you think about this, it makes a certain amount of sense. Fathers never actually know that they are, in fact, the fathers. I mean, nowadays, yeah, you can have genetic testing done. Go back in time. You couldn't. It was even only really 60 years ago that you have a blood test done, and that's not conclusive. Right? I mean, genetic testing, that's quite recent. Most of our evolutionary history, that was just, you had to use some sort of phenotypic cue. Now, who really wants the dad to stick around and help take care of the young? Mom's family, right? Because if the dad goes, I don't think that's mine, I'm not helping with that, Who gets stuck putting additional energy and resources into childrearing? The mother's family. If they can pass some of this off onto the father or the father's family, woohoo! Less expensive. So yeah, makes sense. What can you do to try to convince the male that this actually is his baby? Tell him it looks like him. Because frankly, that's all you really had in the past. Okay. Now, interesting little thing with this in terms of certainties. So, we've got a female and we've got a male. They get together. They produce some offspring. Let's assume they produce a boy and a girl there. So, here we go. Next generation. The girl finds a boy. The boy finds a girl. And they have kids as well. Now, in terms of certainties, here, mom is certain that her daughter is, in fact, her daughter. Mom is also certain that her son is, in fact, her son. So, the reds represent the females, the mums, the blues represent the males. Dad here cannot be perfectly certain that this is, in fact, his daughter, nor can he be perfectly certain that this is, in fact, his son. So, from the very first generation, mum is certain that both of these kids are, in fact, hers. Dad is not certain. Paternal uncertainty comes in immediately. Next generation down here. Now, grandma, who knows this is her daughter, knows that this is her granddaughter and this is her grandson. She is certain of this. There is no ambiguity. Over here, though, mom, who was certain, I mean, dad still, but I didn't know, couldn't be certain it was his daughter, could be even less certain that these are actually his grandkids. All right, no idea. Mom, certain that this is her son. But with respect to these grandchildren, she cannot be certain that this actually is biologically her granddaughter or this is biologically her grandson. Who knows? Her son's partner, wife, significant other could have been a little trollop that's sleeping around. We have no idea. Mom can't actually, you know, grandma now can't actually tell. Let's go down to the great-grandchild sort of generation here. This point here, this great-granddaughter and this great-grandson are now venerable ancient ancestor here, who's respected and whatnot for producing all of these progeny through down through the years, knows that this is, in fact, her great-granddaughter and her great-grandson. For all the rest of these poor kids, there's no clue. As soon as a male comes into the picture, certainties vanish. Okay? So, we do find some actually interesting things in terms of maternal and paternal grandparents as well, in terms of how much investment they put into to the grandkids. So, things that go through the female line tend to get a little bit more attention. Why? It's a given. I mean, you may think that these are actually your grandkids over here, but what if they're not? What if you've been investing precious resources into someone that's not biologically related to you? The R values are zero. You've just engaged in what's called genetic altruism. You've been tossing resources away for somebody else's genomes, not yours. Okay. So keep that in mind. Another thing that's fairly unusual about humans is that we have what's called cryptic estrus, or another word is concealed ovulation. There are no blatantly obvious physical indicators of estrus. Well, this is very different from most other primates. I mean, in most other primates, when a female goes into estrus, oh, her bum turns bright red, or she gets genital swelling, or something happens. It's fairly apparent. Ever had a cat go into heat? Ever run cats? Yeah, they're pathetic creatures. It's like, if they just don't get outside, they will just die. And it's like, I do not need any more kittens. So we took in a stray cat once. My wife likes cats. I have issues. And so I was making breakfast years ago, and I was at the back of the window. I said, hey, you like cats? There's a small cat walking up the back path in our yard. Why don't I finish breakfast, you go see the cat, you know. She doesn't come back in. After a few minutes, like, what happened? The cat get her as I go out? And she's like, well, she's losing. It's a stray. It's hungry. Look at his poor thing. It's like, oh. such a suck. Fine, bring it in. She's like, well, we'll just leave it. It's like, no, take care of the animal. Like, yeah, what do I do? I don't have any tuna. What do I have to feed a stupid cat? He's not supposed to get milk. Will it eat king crab? I've got a can of that. It's like, oh, that should be fine. $8 can. Fine. Feed this cat. So it's like, well, we can just take it to the pound. It's like, no, if we just take it to the pound, it's going to be put down. We need to find someone to take this cat, okay? We need to actually get it a home because we're not... For a little while, find out. Wife goes, does the cat look fat? Yeah, it should, given the amount of king crab and stuffing it when switched to other cat food. You know, it's like, yeah, of course, the amount it's eating. It's like, no, like, not fat fat, but like Prego fat. It's like, oh... Because we hadn't been letting the cat out since it came out of the house. Sure enough, the thing came to us pregnant. Got a bunch of kittens. Then she went back into heat shortly after that. We eventually got her fixed and found someplace for her to go. But yeah, let me tell you, a cat in heat trying to get inside, and all the male cats in the neighborhood show up. They're all outside the door of the house. The cat's like, drag yourself across the floor. It's like, let me out. I must have sex. It's like, no. That's the thinking that got us into this situation in the first place. We're not going back there. Anyways. But we don't have that with humans, right? Last time I checked, when women are heading into estrus, their bums don't turn like bright red or blue. There's nothing sort of like there. What this means is that human males can't actually be certain or sure or even take a really great guess as to when women are most likely able to conceive. Cats do it. Chimpanzees do it. Macaque monkeys do it. We have concealed estrus. Now, there are some subtle signs. There's some evidence that there's subtle... olfactory cues that may be indicative of being at the greatest point of conception. And there's some interesting behavioral things. Women are actually more likely to, studies show, women are more likely to actually change their appearance to appear more provocative when they are most likely to conceive, and also to frequent locations where they are most likely able to find someone to mate with, have sex with, where they are most likely to conceive. It's subtle, okay, but you sample enough, your sample size large enough, you do find this. But women themselves aren't always actually aware of where they are in their cycle. Not all women have actually regular menstrual cycles. So, but the body knows, and that's biology for you. It's like, yes, you don't have a child right now. Your purpose is differential reproductive success. Go out, have sex, do it. But I'm in the middle of a degree right now, and I'm trying to sex! That's how males exist pretty much all the time. Women only have to contend with it for a few days each month. So, there are some interesting theories out there as to why you would have concealed ovulation. And depending who you talk to about it, you get some rather different ones. So here's a few things with respect to concealed ovulation, some theories. One possibility is the concealed ovulation would actually serve to increase paternal certainty. This would occur because a male would have to basically stick around the female. If the male doesn't know when she's actually likely to conceive, he can't just show up for that short period of time, bring a box of flowers, some chocolates, have sex a few times, then take off. He's going to have to be around all month, trying to have sex with her the whole time, which probably means lots of courtship gifts, all kinds, because he doesn't know. So this could lead to pair bonding. The more time you spend with the female, the more likely you'll develop some other sort of emotional connection bond, whatnot, and so the longer you're going to be there. Even if he doesn't lead to that emotional bond, probably the female's been getting resources out of this male this whole time. So that's a possibility. Now, if the male has been essentially around the female so much, this is also what we call mate guarding. So if the male has been mate guarding the female, keeping other males away, this would increase his at least feeling that any offspring that is produced is in fact his. So this may increase the paternal certainty. The more certain you are that this is your offspring, the more likely you're actually going to invest resources into that offspring. So that's one possibility. Second theory that's out there says, hey, this would actually serve to decrease paternal certainty. Wait a minute. We got one theory saying it would be adaptive because it increases paternal certainty. We got another one saying it's adaptive because it actually decreases paternal certainty. How does that work? Well, it has to depend a little bit on the different theorists when they come up with these as to when they think concealed ovulation evolved. So in the increased paternal certainty theory, this suggests that it evolved relatively late in our ancestral development, like maybe only, about 1.5 million years ago. For the decreased paternal certainty argument, this suggests that this may have evolved going back, maybe 4 million years ago. Now, if you look at many non-human primates, dominant males will actually, if a new dominant male comes in, so if the dominant male gets displaced, a new male comes in, will actually go around and commit infanticide, will kill the infants that are already there, because they're not his. He knows they're not his, because he knows that he wasn't around those females when they were in estrus, and so they're not his. Get rid of them, drive the females back into estrus, impregnate them, and the next batch of offspring will be yours. Now, if you've got concealed ovulation, and so the argument of this one is, if you go back maybe 4 million years, if we had a much more, even if it wasn't perhaps dominant males securing a whole bunch of females to mate with at once, even if it was sort of a promiscuous situation like modern chimpanzees, well, males might at least be cognitively able to go, you know what, I'm pretty sure I did not have sex with that female when she was in heat. That definitely can't be my offspring. Given the chance, I should kill him. Now, if you don't have concealed estrus, if you have concealed estrus, so if there's nothing obvious that indicates when a female is in heat, male will go, I did have sex with that female, but hey, we're a species. I mean, I don't think our ancestors, I don't think Australopithecines thought this way, right? But let's just pretend, okay? Right? It's like, imagine the Australopithecine was cognitively capable of having this thought process here, right? I don't know when the female is most likely to conceive. I did have sex with that female, but I have no way of knowing whether or not my having sex with her actually led to this baby being born. It could be my son or my daughter. It's like hairy like I am. Of course, probably all Australopithecines were. All right, so it's possible it's mine. If I kill it, I could be killing my own child. I might be reducing my differential reproductive success. To kill the baby or not. Maybe I just leave it alone. Okay? So this could lead to a reduction in infanticide. But if this were the case, this probably would have had to evolve quite a while back. Like probably going back in the order of 3.5, 4 million years. Whereas the first one may have happened somewhere in the last 1 to 2 million years. Third one here, allows female to secure more courtship gifts. Well, if males can't be certain when the female is going to be maximally able to conceive, you need to try to have sex with her a lot. How do you do that? Keep bringing her gifts. Look, I killed a squirrel for you. Whoop, I found some honey. Oh, here's a dead antelope. Did I kill it? No, but somebody else did, and I brought most of the remains of the carcass to you. Huh? Sex? Any chance of that? Yeah. More honey? Okay, I'll go get some. Man, bees hurt. And if the female's getting courtship gifts from multiple males, woohoo! You go, girl. That's calories that you need to produce your offspring. This would be very adaptive for the females. Maybe not so adaptive for the males, but this could be a massive benefit for the females. As the needs for energy, for maintaining a pregnancy. And keep in mind as well, right? Males probably can't tell for at least a few months whether or not the female's pregnant or not. So even after she is pregnant, she may still have multiple males that are bringing courtship gifts and bringing resources to her. Score. Great way for females to get resources. Last theory here. This one's a little bit odd. I'm going to mention this one because it was came out in the 70s and people seemed to like it for a while. But it's actually based on a real misunderstanding of sort of evolution here. This one says, concealed ovulation would prevent females from avoiding pregnancy. Pregnancy is risky. You can die in pregnancy. Females are smart. Our ancestors had these big brains. Okay, you didn't have the problem with dying in pregnancy until we get the larger brains, right? Once we get the larger brains, perhaps you're cognitively aware enough to make the connection between, huh, pregnancy is risky. If I get pregnant, this could kill me. So, the argument here is concealed ovulation evolved to prevent females from figuring out, yeah, you know, just a few days before menstruation, that's when I'm most likely to get pregnant. I should just make sure I don't have sex then. But if you don't know, if there's nothing obvious, like, yeah, look, my bum just turned bright red, and then, yeah, it's funny, when that happens, you get pregnant. So if there's no obvious overt signs, so women, if even the females don't know, I wonder if I'm most likely to conceive right now. Should I not have sex now, or should I? I can't tell. Maybe I shouldn't risk it. So this argues that concealed ovulation evolved to keep women from actually figuring out when they were going to conceive. So basically, now here's where this is a problem. This says, we've been evolving to get larger brains. We've been evolving greater cognition. But this is the problem, because if women get too smart, then they're going to say, I'm not going to reproduce. So basically, the smart women stop reproducing. Right? Because it's a risk. If I have babies, I could die. I will just be very clever and not reproduce. So what's the solution? So the idea, if you get smart, you stop reproducing. So the smart ones don't reproduce. So in other words, this should be saying only dumb female ancestors reproduced. But wait, the argument behind this is the reason that concealed ovulation had to evolve was because females were smart enough to figure out, one, how the reproductive cycle worked, and two, that it could be dangerous. But by the very argument, the smart ones stopped doing it, so females should become too dumb to figure it out, so you don't need... You see why this is a problematic interpretation? See the problem with this theory? Okay. So, I just mentioned it because, I mean, if you get interested in the stuff and read back through the literature, you may encounter this one. But it's a very poorly, I mean, on the surface, it seems like, it's like, well, that makes sense from evolution, but when you start parsing it out, it really doesn't. The first three here, yeah, those, there's good, that works evolutionarily. This fourth one doesn't. All right. Let's take a look at a few examples here of sexually selected characteristics or traits in humans. We'll just mention a few, and then I'll talk about a few of these in more detail. So males, things like beards. How do we know that beards are a sexually selected trait? Well, if beards actually had some sort of natural selection value, if they actually conferred a survival benefit, we would expect that all members of the species, males and females, would have beards. Now, that sounds like dwarves out of Tolkien, okay? Lord of the Rings dwarves, you know. Females have beards too. We don't have that. So it suggests there's nothing inherently natural selected based, nothing survival, no survival benefit in having a beard. That suggests that the fact that we do have beards here, at least in males, implies there's some sort of sexually selected value to this. Voice, males tend to have deeper voices than females. They tend to have greater upper body musculature than females, and they tend to be a bit taller than females as well. There's obviously variation in all of these things. Things like upper body strength, upper body musculature. What's the value of that? Well, the real value of having upper body musculature is probably not hunting. You might think, well, you need that to kill game. You know, it doesn't actually take a lot of force to smash in the skull of an antelope or sit in a tree with a rock and then drop it on something that walks below you. Doesn't take a lot of effort to throw a small stone at a rabbit or a squirrel. It takes good hand-eye coordination. Doesn't take a lot of physical strength. So what does the upper body strength, what's it for in males? Probably it's for fighting other males. Our upper body strength is useful for punching. you don't usually punch an antelope to death. Right? I mean, you know, if you're going to hunt an antelope, you set a snare, you drive it over a cliff, you throw a spear at it, you drop a rock on it, but you don't, like, wait in the grass for a zebra and just, like, punch it to death. Okay? I mean, the zebra's going to kick your ass. Try it sometime. Go out to Elk Island, okay? Try to punch out a buffalo. But make sure you've got your will worked out, because the buffalo is just going to go, toot, and kill your ass. That'll be it. Right. And that's why stupid people got taken out from our gene pool. No. I mean, what do you do with the upper body strength if you're a male? You fight other males. If you look at other species that have sexual dimorphism, like, take a look at lions. What are male lions really good at? They're not really good at hunting, as it turns out. They can get by, but they're not great. What are they really good at? They're really good at killing other male lions. They're not really good at chasing down things like gazelles. They're a bit too bulky. They can do it, but they're not great. But, you know, other male lions come to you to fight. You don't have to, like, chase them down. Human males. Upper body strength, good for fighting other males. So intrasexual competition probably here. Height may also come into play with that. Bigger males, taller males, height advantage in fighting, punch down the top of somebody's head. Females, a variety of things here, waist to hip ratio, talk about that in a few minutes. Things like larger eyes, things like large eyes and small jaw. These are what we call neotenous features. These indicate youthfulness. Babies, proportionally, if you ever have a chance to, you know, really think about this and look at a baby's head or see the skull of a baby picture, and hopefully not an actual skull of a baby. It's like, oh. But it's like, no teeth. Lower jaw, proportionally, much, much smaller. Okay. Rest of the, you know, their brain hasn't really expanded yet. So proportionally, their eyes look bigger. Okay. Disney doesn't actually produce, neither do, like, say, Japanese anime, produce representations of humans that are really real. Cute, right? Big eyes. Right, small noses, smaller jaws. We love these characters. They're so adorable. Why? Because they're like little children. Ah! Take a look at the villains in Disney. They actually are more realistic in terms of human character. I mean, they may exaggerate characteristics, but think about who's the villain in Beauty and the Beast. My daughter's been watching this a lot recently. I can't remember. It's like the hunter guy, okay? Facial form is actually much more proportionately human. Smaller eyes, larger, compared to like Belle or something, or even the Beast, right? Much cuter, much more neotenous. Other characters, things like shiny hair, fuller lips. As you age, the hair becomes more brittle. Okay, so this can be an indication of youth. The full lips, that's maintained by estrogen. Little girls don't have full lips, full body lips. Boom, that comes on with estrogen, okay? Then menopause hits, estrogen goes away, drops back down, lips get thinner. So again, these can be indicators for males of females that they should try to mate with, reproductive females. The younger the female is, remember we said, I mean, interbirth interval may be like up to 3-4 years, so the younger the female is, the more children you can actually have with that female. So looking for youthfulness is important for males. Dominance is what females may be looking for in males. The more dominant males are more likely to gain resources, more likely to be able to get resources, more likely to actually perhaps be able to either gain or enforce alliances with other males that will then be bringing more resources in, so it's more protected. So these are things that women look for, men look for. Now let's take a look at beards. Psychologically speaking, beards are odd. If you look at the psychological literature, you get a real bimodal sort of distribution of the papers out there. Some papers articles come out finding a negative perception of beards. So some psychology studies find that men with beards are described as being reckless. They're described as having a certain dirtiness about them. Lower mental competence and lower intellectual ability, reduced social maturity, and reduced physical attractiveness. Oh dear. But don't worry. Other articles come out saying that, in fact, actually, there's positive perceptions such as masculinity, strength, intelligence, and desirability. Why the difference? Well, these are articles that have come out over a number of years, different decades. Male facial hair, in at least North America, follows trends. It becomes as much influenced by celebrities, Hollywood media, fashion as anything else. You go back in time, and the wearing of beards was, in cultures, generally much more common. Why? Well, here's another thing. Razors. Okay? Modern time, you can have electric razors, mechanical razors, you can have, you know, disposable razors. In the past, if you were going to shave yourself, you had to take some knife and start scraping it across your face. The technology of steel in the past. Yeah. I mean, the Greeks did this with, like, bronze razors, but not the sharpest of things. Can you imagine trying to go back in time to, like, you know, Paleolithic period where you don't have metal? You got, what have you got? I've got a flint knife. Oh, yeah, are you shaving today? With a stone? Yeah. Oh, there goes my lip. Just four beards, right? Okay. So, here's a study by Reed and Blunk. Just one example that found a positive contribution to perceptions of social, physical attractiveness, personality, composure, and confidence. A is attractiveness, B is personality, C is competency, and D is composure. They showed, now in this case, they showed their subjects, see, here's the other thing with studies on beards. They often don't use real people in the representations. They may be like sketches or pictures, or, you know, sort of like the police composite boards, like, you know, you saw someone do the crime here, you know, flip them until you get, like, the eyes right and then the nose right. It's a little panels, you put them together, and that's what it looked like. They'll use things like that. A few studies have actually used, why did they do this? Well, they do this because of control. So if, like, we said, okay, so here's, let's say, we've got, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, me, five guys in the classroom here today, different amounts of facial hair, but we've also got different shapes of heads, other hair, ages. We can't control that. You just draw a picture. The only thing you change is the type of facial hair. There's a control. There's been a couple of studies that have taken, like, the same guy and then used, like, makeup props, like fake beards and mustaches and things to change things. But again, there's always the question, how is it believable or not? All right. So, anyways, in this case here, they used pictures, not an actual person. Doing that, so they had a beard, mustache, and clean shaven. And we find in the case of attractiveness, beard and mustache, well, a little bit. Personality, beards and mustaches definitely gave the man more personality. Competence, maybe the beard, maybe a little more competent. And composure, somehow there's a difference here in terms of composure. You've also got to remember this is 1990, so they're collecting data, 1989 sort of thing. Remember Magnum P.I., Tom Selleck? Yeah. What was popular back then? Giant mustaches, yeah. Sort of thing. So this could be very much a product of this time. Well, when we look at, you know, historically speaking, beards were much more common in males. And there's some possibilities that that beards may actually serve some interesting values. We've talked about honest signals, right? So things that are under testosterone control in males are things like the jaw. The amount of bone deposition in the jaw correlates with the degree of testosterone. Now, males that perhaps and males that have heavier jaws are seen as being more dominant, possibly more aggressive as well, but perceived as having more dominance. You know, a weak chin does not convey a sense of dominance there. So, if you lack that by growing a beard, you can perhaps make your whole lower face look larger. A perception of increased size. Or at the very least, you can't tell. It's hard to tell what's under there. As it turns out, I have no chin whatsoever. I lost it in a card game in 1989, which is why it's down there. Okay. here's another possibility. Could be used to disguise emotions, perhaps. I mean, we get a lot of information by looking at, you know, the lower face here. Ever notice in like poker games now? I think this is a complete cheat. You know, back in my day when you played poker, you didn't wear dark sunglasses and a hat coming all the way down. You didn't have your jacket turned up to your chin. No, in my day, you just look at people. Right? Nowadays, pro poker players, you know, giant aviator, you know, mirrored sunglasses, hat down to there. Yeah, you know, it's just like, oh come on, really? Seriously, you can't avoid giving a tell away. If you can't control your facial expression, you shouldn't be playing the game. Wusses. Anyhow, big beard may help disguise emotional giving things away. You're going to have a confrontation with somebody with another male. And if you can't see, you know, is he really going to attack me? I don't know. Just all I see is a giant beard. I'm not sure what that means. Is he smiling? Is he growling? I can't tell. You know? Is he in a rictus of fear? Or is that, I'm not sure. Maybe I just should leave him alone. Right? ZZ Top. Seriously. The two guys from ZZ Top. I mean, what are their emotions, really? Skin damage as well. Acne. Acne is due to bacterial parasitism. So if you've got acne scarring, this says, hey, your immune system sucks. Congratulations. You just got parasitized. There's been something that's been chewing on you. That's not pretty. That's not a good genome, right? So you grow a beard up to just below your eyes, and you got acne, you can't tell. Could disguise all kinds of things. Okay? So possibly that this allows males to disguise honest signals. We do know that male status is attractive. A classic study by Sadala and colleagues from 87 show this. Now, Sadala and colleagues, we're not doing evolutionary psychology. This is like sort of traditional, hardcore social psych kind of stuff. What they did was they had female subjects watch a silent video of two men interacting in an office space, an office environment. One man is seated at a desk with a typewriter there and seems to have been doing some typing stuff, phone there and stuff. There's another man that's standing up next to him, you know, like pointing at things on some forms, apparently telling him to do stuff. All the women came to the conclusion that the man that's standing, who seems to be the boss, the other one seems to be the secretary, the clerk, whatever, they treated the more dominant male, the one who seems to be directing things, as being of higher status, but also more attractive. And they might be saying, well, wait a minute, what if the guy just was more attractive? What if it was just an ugly clerk? Ah, here's the lovely thing they did. Half of the subjects saw guy A be the clerk, the other half saw guy A be the boss. And guy B, either be the boss or the clerk, conversely. In either case, regardless of which actor was playing the role of the clerk or the boss was more attractive. Dominance, power, that's sexy. Ever seen a picture of Henry Kissinger? You know who Henry Kissinger is? Economist, a few people do, okay. So an American economist became significant in American politics through, oh gosh, the 1960s through still into the 21st century. When Kissinger spoke, politicians listened. He also got a Nobel Peace Prize, which was kind of absurd because he's terribly hawkish about things. Still, never ran for president, never wanted that, but Kissinger, presidents would consult with Kissinger. Kissinger has amazing power. Kissinger is not, and never has been, an attractive man in this sense. But he's a very powerful man. And Kissinger would be seen on the arm with some stunningly gorgeous women. They're not dating him for his looks. Power is hot. Okay? And women are good at identifying. Women are good at identifying which males have status, have authority, have dominance, and which don't. Even within particular little social groups. So even within, like, I don't know, nerds, okay? Women that are part of that group can pick up which nerds are the most dominant nerds. Amazing study done by David Buss, published in 1989, and then more work that came out of the study was published over the next about 3 years. He did a study, cross-cultural study, interviewed, gave questionnaires to subjects from people from 37 different cultures on 4 continents, over 10,000 subjects. Amazing. I mean, that's the kind of sample size that psychologists just like drool about. And I mean, cross-cultural. Right? I mean, a lot of it's like, yeah, we did cross-cultural studies. How? Well, we got people that were at the U of A that came from different countries to do. How long have they been here? Well, some of them have been here since, like, actually before they got into the U of A. So they're culturally contaminated. Well, I wouldn't say contaminated, but yes. Buss actually gets the data from people that are in situ, in the culture. Okay, so, regardless. Ask them a whole series of questions, amongst other things, about mate choice. What are you looking for in terms of a mate? You know, rank order these things. While this was not in every culture the top value, but generally across the 37, if you look at the 37 cultures, within the top three, women said resource potential. And in cases, ambition and industriousness. If the man doesn't have the resources now, but shows ambition and industriousness, in other words, he's going somewhere, it's like, yeah, that's a good characteristic. That's a good trait to have in your guy. That's what you're looking for. Either got the goods now, got the resources, whatever those may be. Obviously, in different cultures, what the resources are can be very different things. Women want them. It's not always the top thing, but it's up there. What about appearance? What about good looks? Generally not the top. Maybe in the top five, but generally not the top. Few cases where it did increase. In the cases where physical appearance was ranked like one or two, these were areas, these were environments that had high parasite loads. Lots of parasitism. Think back to our good genes, honest signals, right? Think for our parasite theory of honest signaling. If there are high parasite loads in the environment, so being infected by parasites is common, and you've got a male that doesn't show, that looks good, in other words, hasn't got all kinds of damage from parasitism, he's got to have a smoking genome. He's got to have a great immune system. To be able to be that attractive in an environment with that many parasites, good immune system. And that's great for your kids, right? Because what kills a lot of kids? Childhood diseases. If you can get a great genomic immune system from the guy, much better chance your kids are actually going to survive age 5. Okay? But the only cultures in which Buss found that appearance was like coming in one or two for females were environments where parasite load is really high. Otherwise, it was in there. It's not like women go, yeah, I don't care if he looks like completely the, you know, Quasimodo, the worst looking thing on the face of the planet. That's okay. As long as he's written, no. It's in the top five, but it didn't tend to be top one. Okay, so either having the resources or having the ability to get the resources. So this, again, factors into ambition and honesty. And again, we think about this from a sexual selection perspective. You go, so how much of, you know, males' aggression, males being more aggressive and more goal-driven, more domineering, how much of that is just because males are jerks? And how much of this is that women made us this way? Over millions of years of evolution. It's not my fault. My aunt, no, okay. You see, this is where it gets kind of ludicrous, right? But this gets back, we talked about these concerns with groups about sociobiology. If you're saying that behaviors are being evolutionarily selected for, then can you use those as an excuse for doing something, you know, inappropriate? Can, you know, the head of the International Monetary Fund, who's now at Rikers Island in New York, after attempting to rape a chambermaid in an upscale New York hotel. Millions of years of evolution. It's like, no, it's not going to work, right? But it's quite possible that male ambition and dominance, the drive to achieve, is because that's what, over the last maybe 1.5 million years, females came to value in mates, males that could provide. Waist-to-hip ratio. So I think I drew an incredibly bad picture of like my sort of peanut person a couple of classes back with waist-to-hip ratio. Work was done by Devinder Singh back in 1993. First study came out of this. Now, Devinder Singh's originally started out as sort of a social-cultural psychologist, particularly interested in issues of eating disorders. So he got a long background on this. 93 starts looking at things from an evolutionary perspective. This is sort of shortly after evolutionary psych kind of starts making a buzz there. Produced bright light. The other one. Yeah, let's go with that. Sure. So, use these little line drawings. Had subjects look at these. So had underweight, normal, and overweight. So top underweight, middle normal weight, bottom overweight. And used waist-to-hip ratios of 0.7, 0.8, 0.9, and 1. So the waist-to-hip ratio is you take the measure of the waist, either a linear measure or, more properly, a circumference measure, and take the measure of the hips, and you produce a ratio. So divide the, let's say, the circumference of the waist by the circumference of the hips. That gives you your proportionate ratio there. So if we even just sort of look at this, right, I mean, narrow waist compared to the hips, and then up to one, they're the same size. Gave subjects these figures and various ways, basically said, rank order these in terms of stuff. Had younger subjects and older subjects. Do I have the older subjects? No, I don't. Well, we won't worry about that. So these were like university-aged students. They were doing this. And when we look at these, you know, so the underweight, normal, and overweight here, so this is health. So they find that overall, normal weight are probably seen as the healthiest here. Underweight's the least, and the underweight somewhere in there. But if we look across the waist-to-hip ratios, 0.7 to 1, 0.7s are being seen across the board here as the healthiest. Over here, attractiveness. Again, the normal range is probably being seen as the most attractive. Let's see, the solid lines are the males, the dotted lines are the females. Notice that they're actually very, very similar. Remember I said earlier on, so if you've got sexual selection characteristics going on, this is affecting both. So both males and females make pretty similar judgments here. They're actually, you know, you sometimes hear, men have no idea what's actually attractive in women, or women have no idea what men are looking for. And he's like, yes, everyone does. People get, you know, it's like, oh, men can't actually determine whether another guy is attractive. Yes, males can. They just don't like to admit it. In a similar way, it's like, no, women aren't, you know, you get the idea. Again, we find that the lower waist-to-hip ratios are rated as more attractive here. Youthful. In this case, actually, the underweight is being seen as about as youthful as the normal weight here. Again, lower ones. Reproductive capacity. This is the only one here where the underweight is given the lowest ratings, so the least reproductively capable. But yet again, the 0.7s are seen as being more reproductively capable than the higher, the 1. So what we find here is generally very similar. The males and female patterns, very, very similar here. So both males and females, on the variety of characteristics here, utilize both waist-to-hip ratio and body weight as a ranking system. Within weight categories, subjects seem to very systematically use the waist-to-hip ratio to make inferences about the various characteristics. And overall here, we're seeing higher ratings for the normal weights than either the under or the overweights, and across the weight categories, 0.7. Now, just to give you some figures here, we find the interesting thing with waist-to-hip ratio is waist-to-hip ratio is not actually tied to particular body shape. So we've got four women here. Well, Venus de Milo isn't really a woman, it's a statue, but you know, you get the idea. Okay, so four representations. Different body shapes, right? By today's standards, Marilyn Monroe in Hollywood is fat. Right? I mean, it's absurd, but, you know, when you compare to a lot of the celebrities now, it's like, yeah, wow, she's a plumpy. No, she's in perfectly healthy, normal weight range. Those are celebrities now. I mean, you know, good God, I just saw something in some magazine my wife had about, like, the anorexics of, I don't know, anorexic housewives of Orange County or something like that. And it's like, holy smokes. It's like, wow. Yeah, a lot of cosmetics worked and no body fat whatsoever. Next time there's a drought, she's just going to die. Yes. So all these women have about a 0.7 waist-to-hip ratio, even the Venus de Milo, which suggests as well here, if you go back and look at ancestral art, pardon me, not ancestral art, but I mean art from our from earlier time periods, you know, what's seen as being attractive, 0.7, around 0.7. Now, it's a little more complicated than this. Subsequent work shows that it's not specifically a 0.7 waist-to-hip ratio that's most attractive. It's not just that. What the waist-to-hip ratio differences between males and females do is distinguish between males and females. That's a first thing, right? Across cultures, there's going to be differences. Across environments, there will be differences here. But the body shapes, if we look at this across body shapes are produced very strongly by our underlying sex hormones. So testosterone stimulates fat deposition in the abdomen and inhibits deposits in the gluteofemoral regions. Estrogen, on the other hand, inhibits fat deposits in the abdomen and maximally stimulates the deposits on the gluteofemoral region. Other areas, too. So basically, thighs and bum. Now, there's another interesting thing here with fat stores. Not all fat is alike. There's what is called survival fat or maintenance fats, and then there is reproductive fats. Males have very, very little reproductive fat. Females have a lot of reproductive fat. Which fat stores do you think get drawn on for reproduction? It's the fats on the hips and the butt. That's the reproductive fat stores. Abdominally stored fats, it would be great if you're in a famine situation, but that's not where the energy comes from for maintaining a pregnancy. Matter of fact, if those fat stores are too low, a woman's reproductive cycle shuts down. Not always, but more often than not. Female anorexics, female triathletes, they just tend not to ovulate. Their body goes, whoa, there's no way we can support a pregnancy. Let's not even start. Make it easy for you. I'm just going to stop ovulating here. If the fat stores come back, in other words, from the body's point of view, if you've suddenly gotten out of that horrible famine or drought or whatever, and you've gotten into a new area where food is available, put the fat stores back on, this is a good time to have a kid. Go for it. If not, we're going to make it easier for you. Because your body doesn't think that your brain is smart enough to figure it out. And frankly, looking at instances of teen pregnancy, probably right. Looking at the number of kids I have, I know that this is right. Okay. So, what we find here is the sex hormones change the shape of the body. So, we talk about an android. If you go type this into Google, you've got all kinds of stuff about porn at this point. Specifically porn with robots or artificial dolls. But what the words used to mean... Or you'll get stuff about the phone, the Android phone. But what Android used to mean was the male shape. Now, it took me a long time. I had to find this image from, like, what was the Pioneer space probe? This is what was carved onto a gold disc to try to let aliens that might find the Pioneer probe know what our species looked like. Okay? Anything else where I typed in Android or you know, gynoid figures is like, okay, this is a whole bunch of, like, robot porn. I can't show that in class. maybe my ratings would go up. I don't know. Okay, so android gynoid. Android means male shape. Gynoid means female shape. Okay, different shapes, right? Males, broader shoulders, narrowing down to the hips, upside down triangle. Female, that sort of hourglassy shape, okay? So there's other things that come in here as well. The sex hormones can be used to indicate age, right? Before puberty, kids look more or less the same. Their waist to hip ratios are about one, pretty much. At puberty, then things change. The girls start putting the fat deposits down on the hips and buttocks, and the males start laying down muscle on the shoulders, upper body. That's when it changes. Menopause, estrogen stops, okay, or at least the levels of estrogen drop, fat deposition shifts. So the body shape can be used to indicate something about age. And historically, this would have been honest signals. Nowadays, of course, as we saw last class, that little student snippet about artificial steroids, we can cheat. Okay, so these would have been honest signals. I know I'm keeping you here extra. I just really want to finish this as opposed to trying to break it up. In terms of this, I said not all subsequent. I mean, Singh initially thought 0.7 was the perfect. You know, that's what cross-culturally is going to be referred. Evolution is selected for a 0.7 waist to hip ratio in females. Not quite true. It's not that simple. When we look at cross-cultural data on waist to hip ratio, we find differences. It depends very much on the environment. In environments where resources are hard to get, hunter-gatherer types environments, we tend to find the overall waist to hip ratios of women, as well as men, are actually much higher. But there's still a difference. The women, the average at least, and there's always exception, but the average female waist to hip ratio, even in cultures for which the overall is higher, is always less than the males. So, if we look here, American blacks, American whites, Mexican Americans, and then the Moost, which are a Mongolian, essentially hunter-gatherer tribe, we've got differences here. So, I mean, take a look at this. For the females, 0.75, 0.73, Mexican Americans, 0.84, 0.76. There's differences, okay? But then compare it to the males. So you go, whoa, Mexican-American females must not be attractive. It's like, no. But you've got to compare it to the local males, right? To the cultural-specific males. In America, both for blacks and whites, about 0.82, 0.84. Mexican-American males, 0.94. The Moost, 0.85. So the males have higher waist-to-hip ratios than the females. There's where this is coming in. So there's other issues here as well with the way that Singh did this in terms of front and side views. So his little static images perhaps were not most... I mean, we don't actually see people just like that all the time. You know, now make an assessment, right? I mean, we're walking about, we're turning. And actually more recent studies on this have utilized this in terms of computer programs. They actually will let the subjects, like, you know, use a little scroll bar, like spin a picture around of an actual digitized person and do stuff like this, or an animation, but look at it from different sides and angles. So what we know now is it's not specifically 0.7 that's the hottest, okay? But what is hot is, within whatever environment, for males, what indicates a gynoid, a good gynoid shape, which indicates health and fertility. And for females, they're looking for something that's indicating android shape, you know, dominance, success, strength, potential to gain resources. Okay, really sorry for keeping you the extra 5 minutes here. Don't crucify me on the evaluations. Let's get your...